Okay, okay. So my name is Sasidharan Balasubramaniam. People call me Sasi. I think the reason is quite obvious. So I'm from the Telecommunications Software and Systems Group. We're a research center in Waterford Institute of Technology. For those of you who don't know where Waterford is, we're southeast of Ireland, about 2.5 hours south from Dublin itself. So I'm actually going to give two presentations today based on the research work that I've been doing. The first part is looking at biologically inspired networks and how the work that we've done can actually support, say, the future emerging cloud research. The second part of the presentation is going to take a bit of a U-turn. We're going to look at how we can actually do networking using biological components, in particular looking from a communication perspective. So this is the outline of the presentation. I'll talk a little bit in the first two slides, a bit of a justification of our research, and then go into looking specifically at just some specific examples that we've applied BioInspire techniques to networking, in particular the services side. Touch a little bit on some IPTV stuff, and under that, of course, is the multiple overlay, which fits into the IPTV work that we've done. So this diagram basically shows literally our whole emphasis of our research work. You know, we're starting to see today that the internet and the communication systems is pretty much, you know, us as human being researchers, users itself are being immersed into this communication systems that's fitting all around us. So we're not just talking about physical networks itself, but we're also starting to see a lot of emergence of virtualized networks that's actually been sitting on top of these physical networks, in particular service networks. One of the driving forces that has attracted users towards the internet and created more reliance of people towards the internet has been services. And we're going to continue to see a lot of this in the future itself. So our whole entire work revolves around how we can actually create adaptive networks at the virtual level, physical level, and even various different types of access networks that hang off these networks. It can be sensors or even nanoscale devices that are going to be embedded into the environment, focusing on the Internet of Nano Things now, not anymore Internet of Things, which I'll touch on in the second part of my presentation. So the aim here is that how you can actually allow these networks to be very adaptive, robust, scalable, and efficient. And we looked at biological systems mainly for those main characteristics, really, and tried to see whether we can map the same characteristics that biological systems through nature have been able to adapt themselves and evolve over the years and apply them to networks. So our main aim of our group is basically looking at how we can create these algorithms from different biological processes and basically to also be able to have some cross applications such that a technique that you develop that have been applied to sensor networks, we might be able to fine tune it, change them a little bit, apply them to other types of networks, say femtocell networks. So we tailor-make some of the algorithms ourselves, looking at biological processes and the problems, creating the technique, and then some of them we actually reuse other people's application, just fine-tuning them and applying it to our network. So we look at various different biological processes, all the way from molecular, cellular, even up to community level, looking at social insects, human behavior, how they interact with each other, and of course, applying them to the different networks, as I mentioned in the previous slide. So in the future, one of our work that we've done, we've had two PhD students working on this, is what we call the future service environment. How we can, number one, in particular, how this could actually fit into the future cloud world. We've seen that the notion of cloud is basically that we're going to have thin clients, all our application and services are all going to be squeezed into the actual end server farms, data centers that's going to be hosting them. So this actually creates brand new challenges, okay? Number one, how are we going to manage these large pool of services that's going to be actually thrown into the cloud? You can actually imagine service providers actually creating these services, just throwing them into the cloud, and you're just going to have a pool of them. How you can actually do service composition in an efficient manner, how you can actually discover these services. These are actually going to be actually key challenges. And secondly, how the underlying network itself is going to be able to deliver these services in an efficient manner to the actual end users. So our whole idea is to look at it from a whole system perspective, all the way from the services down to underlying network and how the combined solution could create more robust system and networks for the end users. So we collaborate with some collaborators in UC Irvine and in Osaka University in Japan. So I'll start off with the actual service level itself. The way we model each service is literally a little blob that you see up there, right? And the services, we actually embed a biological process in the form of an organism life cycle, literally, you know. So they're able to literally migrate, they can replicate themselves, they can actually come with other services and form communities, just in the same way that organisms can form communities. They have a way of actually managing internal energy. So when a user uses a service, they give them energy, and they spend that energy on the actual resource of the data center that they sit on using their CPU or memory. So in the event that they become very popular, they gain a lot of energy, they can actually replicate themselves, spread around to other data centers or other service itself, so that the discovery of these services could be made much more easier. When they actually become more unpopular, they start to lose their energy and then they just die off. So it actually creates a process of actually evolving these services. You know, the end user, the providers don't actually have to do much. Create the service, throw them into the environment, let them live there, and there you go, right? I can see you smiling there. But so what another form of work that the actual service could do is actually even emit advertisements out so that other services could also discover them. Okay, so the service discovery is basically based on what I just mentioned to you, how we can actually do this gradient emission. So when the service becomes very popular, it can actually get a lot of its energy and spend that on advertisement, advertise very, very far, so the discovery could be made easier. Other services that want to compose with it would be able to literally find the advertisement very quickly and discover it. In the event that the service actually becomes a little bit more unpopular, this advertisement starts to reduce, and the service becomes more harder to find, and before you know it, it just dies off. I mentioned earlier about how the services could actually come and form communities. The whole main reason is basically to be able to increase the ability to be able to create more efficient service compositions. So when a query from a user comes, it might come and hit one of the services. They might be able to refer to other services and say, yep, we've composed with that other service, had good relationship with them, and so on. So through this referral process, you can then create a hierarchical structure within the community. Certain services that are very popular will be high up and will be able to give more referrals to other services, such that the discovery would be made more efficient. And of course, as time evolves, these services will then break down, the hierarchical structure can change, the less popular will become more popular, the more popular, if they lose popularity, will just move down the ranks. So we did some simulation works on this to show how the community could interact and how the efficient the search process will actually increase. So I'm going to go down to the underlying network now, just briefly speak about it. We developed a gradient-based routing technique. And gradient-based routing has been looked extensively, in particular in mobile ad hoc sensor networks. And what was our aim here? Our aim here is that if we go back to what I just mentioned earlier about all those services, and if their churn rate is going to be very high, if the service is going to be migrating between the different data centers, especially in a cloud environment, you're going to have a lot of dynamicity of traffic down in the underlying network. So you need to have a very robust routing process in the underlying network to support this. The current technique of actually doing routing, you get a fixed demand matrix between certain source and destination. The provider finds a route. That route stays for a few weeks, maybe even for a month. They don't touch it until the conditions change. Then only they do the configure the new routes. So we found that that process is not going to be feasible. So what we developed is a very flexible routing technique where you don't actually even need the demand information. So the route basically just hops from one hop to the next hop by just sniffing the gradient from one source to the destination. In the event that certain node becomes highly loaded, new route discovery will just divert automatically around it. So before you know it, you can actually efficiently more use the actual resources in the underlying network. So we integrated the two solutions together. We did a simulation work on this. We actually published it in the journal, where we had all these services that sit on the end data centers, and we varied the demand through time, through different zones. So in, say, one zone, we biased it to say data services. The next zone we biased it to low demand, low quality video service. The last zone we biased it to very high demand video. And we wanted to see that when we hammered the traffic to specific types of service, how they replicated and then during the replication process spread and moved to other data centers, how the underlying, number one, how the query of searching this was efficient. Number two, how was the actual routing process done efficiently such that this service could be delivered to the user in a timely manner, right? And this shows just an example of a result that we got, for instance, in the blocking rate when we compared it to other routing techniques such as ANTS or shortest path. We actually had very low blocking rate, and this actually shows the actual throughput that we were able to get was actually much higher than the actual other solutions itself. Okay. So another work that we looked at, which is going to be actually quite important in the cloud world, is that if we're going to actually put a lot of these services all onto the data center, pushing them onto it, energy efficiency is actually going to become a very, very big issue. So you might have all have seen that recently there's been more research in the areas of actually looking at energy efficient and green data centers. So we've also actually looked at that as well. But we took actually a little bit more of a different approach than what other people have looked at. Most of other people have looked at ways of actually, say, in a data center, pushing all services to certain servers and switching all the other servers off, consolidating the actual workload. What we wanted to look at was how we can actually minimize carbon emission in the long term, right? So our scenario is that you might have a data center operator that has data centers in different countries within Europe. Each of these countries has a different infrastructure for producing renewable energy, wind and solar. So what we actually looked at is that any, and we know that renewable energy actually fluctuates with weather. So what we actually looked at was that in any case when a particular country is actually producing higher renewable energy, we move all our services there. So in essence, what we want to do is that we want to use maximum clean energy to power our services. So our aim is long-term minimization of carbon emission, right? So this basically shows our model here. We have data centers. Electricity comes from the electrical grid. You have fossil fuel and renewable energy. When renewable energy quantity increases, we reduce our fossil fuel usage. And we also consider also the temperature and the service demand within the actual country itself. So our whole aim here is that, you know, say for instance, Spain has a lot of sunlight, has a lot of energy created from the solar panels. You wouldn't want to move all the services down there if it's going to be very hot, because in the end you might end up bumping up the actual cooling energy requirements, you know. So we take those all into consideration to maximize our objective. So we did some simulation work. We used real data in our simulation. We got the renewable energy information from the International Energy Agency, some real temperature data, and this can actually show us. We did simulation for 9 cities. You can see that Berlin actually produces very high. But of course, when you look at this very graph, someone might just question and say, why don't you just push all the services to the actual Berlin itself, which wouldn't actually be fair when you consider that Germany has a high population compared to other countries itself. So we considered the quantity of energy that's actually used by that country itself, and we normalized it to create a little bit more of a closer bridge of fairness between the different countries when we consider where we're pushing the services. So we use genetic algorithms, which has a centralized view. We're actually working towards looking at a distributed model at the moment. So what we do is that we took two solutions. One is a bi-monthly one that just periodically just runs the GA and moves the services around to different data centers. Another one is more of a dynamic one. So what we do is that we observe the trend in change of the weather pattern, trend in change of the service demand and temperature. It's only then that we then start to move them around. And you can see the quantity of clean energy we use is actually much more higher as opposed to statically if the services just sit in the data centers. Now, once again, moving all these services around could actually impact on the end quality of the user. So what we also did was that we also measured how much traffic is actually in the underlying network to make sure that we don't overload certain links. And we can see that majority of our links actually are quite lightly loaded. It's only one or two links that are actually highly loaded based on this distribution. We also looked a little bit into IPTV. we've recently found that IPTV has a lot of potential in this cloud world, in particular if content's actually going to be flooded into the cloud. Users should be able to access these contents, have their own personal libraries within the actual cloud itself, and be able to pull contents whenever they want to. So now this then creates a brand new demand, in particular if you have a whole load of service providers all laid on top of this the underlying network. So how could you efficiently, number one, use resources in the underlying network? So we applied our gradient-based routing solution to this. We did collaboration with UCD, University of College Dublin in Dublin. They did some work on looking at quality of experience monitoring, ways of actually looking at, say, packet level information to determine how bad quality of certain streams are to the end users. So we looked at that and we found that our solution could fit very well and maintain the quality of experience quite well. We also looked at how, if you had virtualized providers such as IPTV providers all parallel stacked on top of the underlying network, and each of these providers had their own demand, their own services, how you can actually slice virtualized service resources from the underlying network and then split them all up into each of the layers. So we applied what we call the competition model, which was a bind-spar technique we applied, where you had many different types of species. They're all basically competing for a pool of resources. Some would be more aggressive than others. How you can actually fairly distribute the resource amongst them. So in this case, some IPTV providers would be more aggressive than others. It doesn't mean that the less aggressive guys would just lose out. There'll be a certain amount of resource for them to exist. So it's basically a coexistence of the different providers. And we look from perspective of revenue, how using our model, the carrier could increase their revenue, how the providers could also increase their revenue. So I'll move on to the second part of my presentation now, which is actually looking at protocol development for molecular communications. So it's an upcoming new area of research, started maybe in 2005, 2006. We got into it about maybe in 2007. We had a part-time PhD student working on it. We're starting to get more traction in this area now with more people working on it. So what I'll do is that I'll first, in the first few slides, give an overview of what molecular communication is all about, give some examples of work that's been done and what our personal interests are, which is actually the development of the actual protocols itself, right? So this slide basically actually shows the evolution of research throughout the years, right? Back then we were seeing a lot of research in fixed networks, circuit switch, packet switch when IP came into the picture. We then started to see research in the wireless domain, and then it went down to the actual micro scale, even on body area sensor network. And of course the next phase is going to be in the nano world, when you have a large number of these nano devices, how you can actually communicate between them. And there's actually two strands of research: molecular communication and electromagnetic. My particular research interest is in the molecular communication side of things. So what exactly is molecular communication? Molecular communication is basically a communication paradigm that allows nanomachines to basically communicate with each other. So if you imagine, say, a scenario where you might have a tissue and you have nanomachines embedded in different parts of the tissue, how you can actually communicate between the different nanomachines. But nanomachines are actually different from, say, conventional computing device or even a sensor. You don't have a dedicated antenna or a battery where you can just communicate with each other. So what we do is that we override the underlying communication that naturally occurs in biological system. So we convert our information into biomolecules and send our biomolecules out into the environment. It gets to the receiver and we decode the information, pass it to the machine. Now these nano devices could be in two forms. You can basically have electromagnetic devices or even synthetic based devices, right? What is an example of a synthetic device? There's actually a very good work by a guy by the name of Yaakov Benenson. He was actually at Harvard. Originally he was at Weizmann Institute, but now he's actually at ETH. And he did a work, what they call a DNA doctor, where he created a finite state machine purely out of using just DNA strands. And what this finite state machine could actually do is that you can actually push this finite state machine into a cell, And when a disease actually came to the cell, the finite state machine was able to kick off and know what type of disease it was. And he actually embedded also little drugs in the cell so that the finite state machine will kick off the drug and it will just kill the cancer off. Right? So that's an example of one nanomachine. So the functionality is quite neat. You're using literally synthetic components. But how you can, if you can actually communicate between them, the power of those nanomachines actually even increases even further. So now, crazy as the idea might sound, brings a whole lot of different challenges, of course. You know, I mentioned earlier about how those tiny devices are very different from conventional computing devices. They have very short-range transmission. Their propagation is very, very slow, very unreliable. And directionality is actually quite an issue, in particular looking at diffusion-based solutions. And current conventional communication techniques, you know, it would be great if we could actually reuse them as much as possible, but of course they're also very different. For instance, the way we actually stream information over the internet, we actually take a file and actually chop them up into little packets and stream them through. But in nano communication, if the information is embedded into a form of a DNA, you can actually store a large quantity of information in just one single DNA. You wouldn't actually have to need to actually chop these little packets and send them through. But of course, the reliability issue becomes an issue. So you might have to then disperse a whole many different copies and create a whole redundant environment such that you ensure that one of these molecules actually gets to the destination. So the whole thinking is actually a little bit different, but interesting. So just give an example. This was actually a work done by a friend of mine using calcium signaling. Calcium signaling actually naturally occurs within the cell. They're actually stored in this little thing called IP3. You burst it, and it just fires and propagates from one cell to the next. So they did some wet lab experiments here. You can see when they fired that cell, this calcium signaling started to spread out. And you got amplitude just pushing out. They did. So basically what their whole aim was to show the feasibility of actually doing artificial communication using this so that you might be able to do, say, amplitude or frequency modulation through these calcium ions that get pushed from one cell to another. Another work that this same group did was using what they called microtubules. What exactly are microtubules? So within actual cell itself, you actually have these little skeleton that naturally occurs in the cell. They're called little microtubules. And you have these little molecular motors that walk on these microtubules, and they actually carry information basically from the nucleus to the actual peripheral membrane edge. This is actually what naturally occurs in the cells today for us all. What this group did was artificially try to create these rails outside the cell and get these molecular motors to actually walk on them to carry information from one cell to the next cell. So it's like a wireline connection of cells, literally a wireline network. And they actually have wet lab experiments. Recently, they did another work they published in a special issue that I organized where they showed how these wireline links were able to self-organize between the different cells and spread around. And when these molecular motors actually walk on them, they can actually change the topology. Sometimes they could zip two microtubules. Sometimes when they walk against them, they can actually unzip them. So the actual topology then actually dynamically changes. So very interesting. Another piece of work what these guys in NTT Docomo did, which was actually the opposite of what you had here, where you had molecular motors walking on the tubule. They did the opposite, where you had these molecular motors all placed on this little glass substrate, and you had this molecular microtubule, a chunk of it, and it actually runs along glides from one source to another destination. And their whole aim is to try to create this on a little biochip, where this biochip can be placed on a phone, such that, you know, a sweat or sample from a user could actually drop on this biochip, and this molecular communication could take your sample around different chemical agents to find out what's actually wrong with you and pass information to, say, some external medical network. Another piece of work, which is actually quite interesting, is actually looking at wireline connection again, but what they call membrane nanotubes. Membrane nanotubes actually naturally occurs within the cells. When the cells actually move along and they bump into each other, they form some kind of an adhesion, and then they pull away from each other. And when they do that, it actually forms these little tubes. And once these tubes are formed, they're actually able to pass all sorts of cargo, vesicles and whatnot, through those tubes. And you can actually even get viruses that can actually glide along these little tubes here. So what other people have also done was how we can actually create these tubes artificially using phospholipids. So through just a pipette, you're able to blow it out and create connections between them, and they created various different types of topologies from that. So what is my interest? The work that I presented, a lot of that has been looked at up till now, has been very physical layer. My interest is actually looking at how we can actually develop these protocols that can support these molecular communication. And I looked at two solutions. One was looking at calcium, and another one was looking at viral particles. So you might, in the calcium case, you might have short-range transmission. The viral particle might be more long-range transmissions. You can have in-body, literally internet within the actual body itself. So my aim here is that in the same way that protocol stack has existed in various different types of devices, all the way from fixed wireless ad hoc sensors, can we use the same stack and try to actually embed them into a biological cell? So now this actually is quite crucial, because quite a challenge, I should say, because how do you actually get software components that can actually be translated into cell functionalities? So we do this through two forms of molecular computing, enzyme-based and DNA-based computing technique. So in the enzyme-based computing technique, we found a work that was done by a group at Siemens, Martin Stetter, who is actually able to create logic gate operation through the actual pathway signaling that occurs in the cell. He's able to do quite complicated difference logic circuits from that. So what we then did was that we tried to develop a logic gate, simulated it, that overrided this pathway, where if a certain disease actually came, the logic gate kicked off, triggered the IP3, and the calcium signaling actually flows through. So scenarios could be that you might have many different sensors. They're dumb sensors. As soon as they just detect some disease, you might be able to transmit information, go through some kind of a gateway. But what we also were, what one of this PhD student actually found out was that you can actually program a different amplitude and frequency of these calcium signalings that flow out if you can actually have a different sensitivity on the cage. So if you come through this different sensitivity, you can get different amplitude, different frequency. So if you can actually have different sensitivity from them, then you could get different amplitude, different frequency, which inherently is basically addressing that you can have in the actual calcium signal that actually flows through. So you'd know from which node was actually fired from. So another piece of work was using the DNA viral particles. This is actually quite interesting, because our assumption here is that you might have message that's actually in the DNA form, like the DNA doctor that I mentioned earlier to you. But how would you actually transport this DNA strand from one node to another? And we use viruses, because virus has been used extensively in gene therapy to be able to basically transport these DNA strand into a foreign cell, unload them into the foreign cell, right? So the process is actually quite simple. We basically have a message RNA, we have a viral gene, and this whole process is basically where the actual node is in the dormant stage, no transmission, okay? So what actually happens is that if you have some kind of a chemical event that comes through, the short RNA gene gets attracted to that chemical event. So nothing is actually gobbling up the viral gene now like before. So before you know it, the viral gene actually gets excited, grabs the message mRNA and actually pushes out, and you get a viral packet. So it's actually quite a simple step, but quite effective. So the good thing about actually using viruses is also that you're able to actually do addressing also, because you can actually have multiple viruses. So you can actually create different viral packets for different receiving cells. And you can just program the actual receptors on the cell to only accept certain viral packets. So inherently, you can actually do addressing also, just like you can do packet addressing in an internet packet. And so the other good thing about using the virus, as I mentioned earlier, if the infrastructure had a nanotube, the viral packet could actually even glide along the nanotube. So you create a bit more of a wireline connection between the nodes. So another work that we looked at was also looking at neurons. Neurons are actually quite interesting, because they inherently, in their natural form, actually form connections of networks. So our whole aim here was basically how we can actually encode information and then push them through the neurons. And we did some collaboration with Trinity Institute of Neuroscience and CRAN at Trinity College. And our whole idea is that the application might be for neuroprosthetic devices, where you might have a substrate and you can grow neurons on them. They can form a network. But then how you can actually allow communication to actually effectively occur between these neurons. This was a work that was not looked at before, so we looked at that. So what we did at CRAN was we grew a little bit of some neuron in a substrate. And we basically artificially applied some chemicals. You can see at that point, the white point there, it's like a single bit transmission we sent. We did another measurement point in the black point there. You can see that the signal actually transmitted. You can see the neurons surrounding actually sparking and firing and sending signals out. And when we applied the mecalamine, that actually stopped the signaling. So it's like an on-off switch. So what in effect you can actually have is a device that has these two chemicals interface to a neuron, and when you want to fire it, just release the acetylcholine. When you want to stop it, apply this mecalamine. So what we then looked at was, if you were able to do that and you had a large neuron network that you grew with a single receiver with multiple sensors interfaced to them, how each of these sensors could fire so that you can minimize interference. So it's a typical scheduling problem that you find in wireless network. So we took that, the same process there, we adapted it a little bit, we just used a genetic algorithm optimization technique, and we applied it and we were able to find an optimum scheduling timing that these sensors should fire, such that the actual signal actually travels through and you get no interference to the receiver. A problem with our solution is also that it's a little bit topology specific. In other words, you must know the topology in hand. You must grow the neurons for that, basically that networking topology. But there are works that have been done in Korea where they use carbon nanotubes in certain configuration and you can actually lay the neurons on it in specific patterns, you know. So if you're interested in some of this nano-communication work, there was a journal launched last year in 2010. We organized one special issue just in this year. It's actually spearheaded by Prof. Akildis at Georgia Tech. He's basically the chief editor of this, and there's some good survey papers to give some good background information on this. So these are the people I collaborate with. When I mean collaborate, I basically co-author papers with them. A lot of them are basically bioinspired people, a few networking people. The ones in the orange are actually people that I haven't actually co-authored papers with, but we're in the process of writing papers and submitting it. We have one student that I'm actually co-supervising in Catania. She's actually a student visiting at Cambridge, and my collaborator there introduced me to her, and then we sort of like did some work together. So hoping to get a paper out of it soon. So who can I actually collaborate with here? Obviously, from the actual cloud side of things, I see some potential there. This is just an example, a list of people. In particular, the fact that I looked a lot in the adaptive services side of things, I never actually considered what type of business model these cloud environment might actually take. So how these adaptive services could actually fit for these different business models, that could actually be interesting. I never actually looked at the security side of things in these services. So if you can imagine all these large pool of services being pushed into the cloud, security could be actually quite vulnerable. So, you know, in particular, if these services are autonomous and you want them to interact in a distributed manner, you might want to embed some kind of a trust mechanism into them so that you can only trust certain services when you're composing with them. You know, the other issue I looked at in particular for the green data center, when we actually, if you have, say, data centers over the border from others, how such contents could actually be migrated between them, and whether there are any rights issues or even privacy issues with certain information of users in those services that's actually being pushed around. On the routing and resource management, obviously Professor Hamalainen did some work on pricing-based bandwidth allocation. I'm actually quite interested in that. Could actually fit a lot into the actual multiple overlay work. And even in particular, optimization is actually quite good because we applied the GA-based solution to the service management. There's a lot of potential there. We did some work on actually applying GA to routing. We're not really looking at that. There's one student who did that. He's already graduated. But on the services side, I think there's a lot of potential. And, of course, there's a nanoscience center here, and I'm actually very interested in particular looking at Professor Vuento's group. He actually looked at how you can actually model viruses and bacteria and how that could be detrimental to the human health. And, you know, he has a wet lab experimental facilities there. I'm probably looking the opposite of him from what he's looking at. He's looking at how dangerous they can be. I want to know how they can be useful. So could be some interesting discussion there. And Professor Mackinnon actually did some interesting work on topology optimization, you know, and I really think in the nano networking, in particular, when you look at dynamic topology changes, that can actually be really, really interesting. How you can have different types of carriers, whether it's viruses or bacteria for different topologies, how effective they can be in actually delivering messages to the end receivers. But the another work that we actually published paper recently, it was only 2 months ago in IEEE Communication Magazine, and it's actually looking at a very long term vision of biologically inspired networks. And biologically inspired, traditionally, we take biological systems, try to create an algorithm out of it, and then translate them and then push them into a network. It's actually quite tedious, you know, and it's actually very problem specific. What if we can actually create some more flexibility in this, such that we as ICT people don't actually have to go and research and find out about biological techniques? What if we can actually eliminate the middleman and have the biological system actually drive the actual communication network directly? Then more flexibility could be created there. So we gave one example in that paper where you had maybe a culture of cell driving a network, in this particular case a virtual overlay network, and say the virtual overlay network environment changes, you might inject some kind of an agent back into the culture, might create mitosis, separate into two, and that could then represent two virtual networks, you know. So it creates a new paradigm of how software designs could be done in the future. I'm not a software person myself, but obviously there are software people within the department I'd like to see take this avenue of research such that, you know, you can maybe see how software in the future could be designed in a new way that could interact with biological specimens, you know. You might not even have one biological specimen. You might have maybe multiple different types of biological specimen. And this work, I actually got inspiration from a paper done by a group in Japan that was published in Science last year. And what they actually looked at was how you can actually get slime mold to design a network for you. And basically what they did was they created a map with each of these little dots here was where the food was, and they represented each subway station of the Tokyo Railway network. And they actually placed the slime mold there, and after a number of hours, the slime mold started to spread around, creating all types of network, but before you know it, it created an optimal network. And that actually matched the actual Tokyo Railway network. It's quite amazing. We don't know how they do it. They have some way of actually doing it, but all we're interested in is just the end result of it. This is what I basically mean when I was talking about the biological driven system. Sometimes it's impossible to actually learn every single biological mechanism. Even biologists themselves don't even know when I talk to them, you know. But it might be great if you can just get the end result and that can actually drive a system. You don't have to be limited. It's just communication network. It could be any adaptive system in the future, but this could be one starting point, say, for instance. So my long-term vision really is, you know, it would be great if I could, you know, could start like a biological-inspired group and have two focus, one more on the traditional networking side of things, you know, not only looking at wired, maybe wireless network, but the other is also to look at this nano-molecular scale communication. I really believe that area is going to grow tremendously. And it's a very long-term research. We had a very good start in it. We got very good feedback from people who are actually working around this around the world. You know, in particular, if I could get access and work with some really good wet lab people, not only from this molecular nano, but even what I mentioned earlier on these bio-driven networks, that would be really great. So I'm looking at quite a long-term sort of like a plan there, and of course to strengthen this to some really strong international collaboration. And of course, a lot of the funding that I've been looking at, of course, is in the EU FET, Future Emerging Technologies, recently submitted one proposal with a group in UPC, N3CAT. There's a nano networking center there, so we're hoping to get a result from them. And also some other EU frameworks, in particular the future networks objectives. And also some nano. The nano is more probably into the future emerging though. So a little bit about myself. I left this as the last slide. So I have approximately about 60 publications. I graduated 2 PhD students. One joined CreateNet in Italy. He's now a lecturer at University of Toronto. And another guy just went over this year as a postdoc at University of Ottawa in Canada. I'm currently supervising 4. One guy is going to be submitting very, very soon. He's the guy who's working on these services. And of course, he's co-supervising of this PhD student. I think she's going to be submitting also November, December this year. So some of the funding experience, I got my own PI grant with Science Foundation Ireland. It was a start investigator grant. It was like 109 applicants and only 15 got it. I was one of the lucky ones who actually got that. And the way we actually function in our research center, we're actually put into groups to do proposals. So we successfully got a few basic research funding from Science Foundation Ireland. These are two example projects where I was able to put a bio-inspired work into that. And we actually wrote the proposals together and successfully actually got through. Some of my past research, I did my original PhD was in mobility, in particular looking at context information. How can you can use context and know from which network to go and consider users' quality, their experience in the process while deciding which is the best network for them when they're changing devices also. And this PhD student that graduated with me a few years ago, we did activity recognition in healthcare. So you have an environment full of sensors on devices. So when people manipulate the different device, how you'd know what is the activity they were actually doing. And we focus it on healthcare, in particular for ambient assisted living, for the elderly care. So I'm not really looking too much on that work. I finished that about 3 years ago. So I'm participating a lot in TPCs for various conferences, largely in the network management conferences, because traditionally that's our main strength of our research group. The last, say, 3 or 4 years, I've been more involved with the bio-inspired world and recently in the nano world. You know, as I mentioned earlier, we had one special issue. We're trying to organize another special issue. We submitted a proposal for it to WirelessCom, so we're hoping to get the result within the next 2 months. So in conclusion today, I presented two main areas of my research work. One's on the actual bio-inspired networking side, looking in particular at services and IPTV. And then the second part of the presentation is a bit more radical, looking at molecular comms for nanomachines. So I talked a little bit about the protocol interest that we have and some collaborative work that we did in the neuronal side of networks. We're also doing other works in looking at bacteria networks, but we haven't actually published that yet, so I didn't actually present that today. And that's the end of my presentation, really. Are there any questions I can help you with?
You were talking mostly on the molecular communication. Here you mentioned also the enzyme and DNA-based computing. So how do you see the field in general? What will happen? Is it the sort of computing-related applications and the huge scalability that's the main theme, or is it more like nano-level embedded applications for medicine and others that will drive the evolution or the development of these techniques?
That's a very good question. Obviously, a lot of this application will be heavily focused to the healthcare side of things, monitoring, drug delivery. I see them as being basically the driving force. But having said that, that driving force will require heavily a lot of, you know, smart computation techniques that you can actually push down to such a nanoscale device. So that one example was that DNA doctor. I'm sure there's going to be a lot more of those. But the DNA doctor, as impressive as it is from a practicality perspective, you can't embed such mechanism into, say, a billion, trillion cells within a human body. So if you can have communication to support that, then the effectiveness of that actually increases. We actually presented this to a doctor to see what they thought of this, you know, and one doctor said that it's actually a very good idea because for one particular case, say for instance, is recurrent cancer in patients. When patients who have cancer go to operation, they actually remove the cancer, but sometimes the cancer is actually hidden. You can't actually search them. So the next time you want, if you can only wait till the cancer spreads, you go do screening, it's only then that you'll know. But what they did say was that if you had this such communication techniques embedded in different parts of the tissue, you might be able to detect and localize more early such hidden cancer. This is one example of that. Another group we talked to in Tyndall in Cork was how you can actually do drug delivery more effectively, maybe even using the molecular motors, especially if the rails could self-organize to certain nodes. You can get the molecular motors to actually carry the actual drugs to the actual location. So it's a bit of both, really, to answer your question. I hope that answers your question.
Yeah. So your answer is more based on this sort of mid-term research results. So how do you see the evolution in the future, say 20 to 30 years? So will the computers be still a sort of electrical computers?
Okay.
Or will the biological computing and communication be
dominated? I really, really believe that we will have more biological processes, biological computing playing a big, major role. I think that huge breakthrough that really triggered everyone's mind was this work done in Japan. You literally got the actual biological system to do the thinking for you. And we tried to actually mimic systems by actually looking at biological processes, which was BioInspired, and that was, it did solve a lot of problems, did a lot for us. Genetic algorithm, you can say, was quite successful in various different applications. But it also had its drawbacks, I think. And then one way of actually looking at it was then why don't we actually try to target more of letting the biological system doing the thinking for us. I really see that as being having a very, very good impact in the near future. You know. So, yes, to answer your question, I see more biocomputing as being literally the way forward, but not only just in communication networking side, even other types of adaptive systems, more smarter materials could be created from them too. Yes.
To the first part of your lecture, to this bio-inspired
yes.
Development, how in this research, how do you treat this analogy to the bio world? Is it guiding in searching for the solutions to the problems given in the network?
Right.
How is this inspiration to be interpreted? So
sure. Yeah. That's a very good question. It's very problem specific, if I could start by saying that. You know, so say for instance in the services, we thought, hey, how could we make them live on their own? You know, what is one way we can look at them? So we went and then we thought, okay, maybe this living, why don't we just treat them like a living organism? We let them live with each other on their own and then we don't have to worry about them. Just like in nature, you can have many different organisms that coexist together. That, you know, some kill each other, yes, but others are also able to coexist. You know, another, just to give you a very quick flavor, we did another piece of work where we looked at, you know, if you had a single path of traffic, and you had multiple traffic inside that one part, how do you evenly share between them? Especially if this change in the traffic demand happens in different phases, short term, medium term, long term, you know. And what we actually looked at was we applied the way the actual body maintains the energy inside. We called it the blood glucose regulatory model. And that, the good thing about that was we found in that model it had a short, medium, and long term process. And it just matches it closely. So it's very problem-driven. We look at the problem, and we go to the biology and say, hey, what seems to be the biological process that seems fits best into this? Pick out the models and then create the algorithms and apply it. Yeah.
Okay, perfect. Thank you for the presentation.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it very much. So.